Hey, JD here. Welcome to the Mead House. You know, over the past several years, we've brought you over 150 episodes of mead making education, information, and entertainment. More than 100 guests have stopped by the Mead House, professional mead makers, medal-winning home mead makers, competition organizers, experts on yeast and honey, and brewers just like you and me have all visited to share their knowledge. Hey, the Mead House is produced for home mead makers and brewers looking for a bit of inspiration and information from the many guests and discussions we have here at the house. You can help support the Mead House by joining the Mead House Keyholder Club on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com and search for the Mead House. There's also a link in the show notes. For as little as $2 a month, you can become a key holder. We've teamed up with some great companies to provide thank you gifts for your support. So get on over to Patreon, join the Mead House Key Holder Club, and get your own set of keys to the Mead House. You can listen to the Mead House podcast with your favorite player, and be sure to rate us 5 stars on iTunes or your favorite listening venue. The Mead House. Mead making entertainment you just don't want to miss. Hey, welcome to the Mead House. And for the second year in a row, the Mead House Iron Bee competition is back. And the secret ingredient is once again sponsored by Mountain Rose Herbs. Hey, let me tell you, if you want to make your food taste better, check out the products at Mountain Rose Herbs and elevate your culinary hobby by including some of their herbs and spices. I love their Mexican oregano. Include a pinch in your guacamole, 2 avocados, chopped tomato and onion, pinch of salt and a squeeze of lime, and then grab a pinch of Mountain Rose Herbs Mexican oregano and mix. It adds a great new dimension to your guac. Hey, get all your herbs and spices, teas, and more at MountainRoseHerbs.com. And Mountain Rose, we certainly appreciate your support. Hey, Jeff and Ryan are both seated at the bar. I'm J.D. Webb. Thanks for listening to episode number 150, guys. 150 episodes in the can when we get done tonight. That's really something. You know where to find us on...
Wild.
Yeah, it is, man. You know where to find us, iTunes, Stitcher Radio. I'm not going to read the whole list here. You can find them on the front page of the website. Hey, in this episode, in segment one, I just read the promo for Mountain Rose Herbs, and tonight we're fortunate to have Jessica Nebesny from the marketing team with us. We'll be covering several topics, including herbs and spices and whole and powdered. In segment two, Jeff and Ryan have a 411 update for the Iron Bee, and I thought we'd talk a little bit about melomels, specifically, you know, the different types of flavors, whether you're using real fruit, concentrates, juices, and whatnot. There's just a ton of stuff available out there. And finally, Facebook friends. This is where we try to answer questions with no formal expertise other than what we've experienced in our own brew room, all that and more here at the Mead House. But first, hey, thanks to all of the Mead House key holders who help keep the Mead House podcast free. You too can become a Mead House key holder and help support the show for as little as $2 a month. We've got some great thank you gifts to send to you. Get on over to patreon.com, search for the Mead House, or just click the link in the show notes. Hey, what are we drinking tonight? Double fisting it in Mead House fashion here tonight. Because it's March and this is, St. Patrick's month, I guess, or whatever, I have this little cool, cocktail, that you want to try. Now, go to your liquor store and look for the Jameson Cold Brew, Irish whiskey. That's a limited production. So you want to get it now while the getting's good. 2 ounces of cold brew, Jameson. 1 ounce of your favorite Kahlua, Patron XO Cafe. Avion makes a real nice one. And about 1 ounce of simple syrup if it's not sweet enough for you. And then top it up with about 1 ounce, 1.5 ounces of cold brew coffee. And if you really want to get after it and increase the fattening level of it, put a dash of heavy cream in it and mix it up. That's really good. In my second bottle here, my second glass, I'm drinking one of Ryan. I get this, you know, there was a suspicious box at my front door. I had no clue that this thing was even sitting there. It might have even sat there overnight because I opened the door one morning and here's this box sitting by my door. Where in the hell did this come from? Well, inside was just a whole bunch of different meads and bottles and, you know, a bunch of them from Ryan. Ryan, I'm doing, this is labeled sparkling lemon and it's very refreshing, highly carb. Has a, I'm very suspicious about this. I almost detect you use some kind of a citrus hops in this. Am I right on that?
No hops.
No hops
at all.
Has a little, I don't know, a little bit of that vegetal. I mean, it's not bad. It's not, you know, it doesn't turn you off or anything on the aroma side, but the flavor, outstanding, dude. You know, I had your other one a couple of days ago. What was it called? The citrus? Can't find my.
Yeah, it was essentially an orange mead.
Yeah, and
not at Joe's.
It was there was a little bit of sweetness up front. It was high, like this one. It was highly carved. I got lemon and lime. I didn't really detect any orange, and unfortunately, the bottle's gone. It finished nice and dry. It had a nice tartness to it. Really good balance between the tartness and the sweetness. Of course, like I said, the sweetness was right up front, right instantly, and then it kind of dissipates real quick. Had kind of a honey. There was a honey aftertaste to it. Really good, Ryan. That's one that I would keep a couple of cases on hand for the summer, along with this sparkling lemon. This is really refreshing. And, wow. I would have thought it almost tastes like there was some hops in it. I'm thinking what, lemon zest, lemon rind?
That it's just lemon juice.
Lemon
all
juice.
All I did in that one was lemon juice and honey, and used more honey as the priming sugar. Actually, used some lavender honey from our friends over at Bear Honey to do that one. And yeah, you know, as you say that, I think that the next time I make a batch of this, Maybe I'll dry hop it with like some lemon drop hops.
Oh yeah,
and see what happens there.
Yeah,
that'd be nice.
Yeah, it would. Really good stuff, Jeff. You know, from week to week, you've always got something either unusual or different. Of course, I guess one is synonymous with the other, right? Unusual and different.
More often than not, they are one and the same. This week, I am playing one of my favorite games for What Am I Drinking? Double fisting it as usual. And this week, I am playing co-host roulette. Was cleaning out the fridge the other day and happened upon an unlabeled bottle with a silver cap that I believe was one of JD's creations. And then another bottle with a little paper label that says sour braggot with fruit. which I believe was one of Ryan's. So trying the one I believe is yours first.
What is it?
It is a braggot. Can okay. Taste the honey, can taste the malt. I'm also getting some kind of a raspberry or kind of a fruity flavor to it. It might be blackberry.
That might be one of the blackberry.
You think that's mine?
No, I think that's JD's.
Yeah, it's got to be JD's.
It may be a blackberry. I had a blackberry quite a while back.
Yeah, this was probably in the crate of stuff that I took home from the bee. So, yeah, I believe this is a blackberry braggot. It's really nice. Has just a little bit of a tart finish to it. The honey is right up front. I'm not getting a lot of hops, but it is a little on the older side, too. So you know, hop character may have faded out of this one, but that's okay. It is still very drinkable. And then switching gears to Ryan's Sour Braggot with fruit. Nice, crisp tartness to this one. Yep, there's some honey kind of like evening out the sourness too. A little of that honey character. I'm having a little bit of trouble putting my finger on what fruit is involved here. That might be raspberry. Could be. No, the sourness almost gives it a kind of a green apple character. Brian, do you recall what fruit went into this?
Passion fruit.
Pardon me, had a little go down the wrong hole. Yeah. Okay, now that you're saying that, I'm getting the passion fruit. The sourness is a little bit, you know, passion fruit is a delicate flavor, so I think they're kind of throwing me off for a second. But I can taste the passion fruit in it now. Yeah. Also very drinkable. This is a nice. Like I said, the sourness just gives it a really crisp finish. A little bit of lingering kind of tingle on the tongue. Yeah, very nice. So, very pleased with my drink selection for the evening here.
Excellent. And Ryan, you, like Jeff, have always got something cool and unusual. What is it tonight?
Yeah. You know, before I get into that, you know, JD, you were talking about a guacamole recipe at the top. I have become a very big fan. Add pomegranates to your guacamole. That really just makes it pop and something extra special. So, you know, follow that JD's recipe and then throw in some pomegranates and you're off and running.
There you go. All right. What's in your cup tonight?
Yeah. So my brother, closest in age to me was down. He lives up in northwestern Minnesota, you know, up in kind of the tundra, I guess. And he works at a brewery up there and brought back a bunch of beers that from his brewery. And I walked in the door, I think 2 minutes before we started recording here. I had some stuff going on and I grabbed one of those. So I am drinking a amber ale from Bemidji Brewing Company. It's very nice. Just a solid, not much to say about it. It's just a solid amber ale. And it's very, got some, it's refreshing. It's not overly sweet. It finishes a little bit on the drier end and is very good for right now. So That's about as exciting as I can get tonight, JD.
Okay. Hey, that'll do it.
Yeah. As JD said, joining us tonight from Mountain Rose Herbs is Jessica Nabesny. Having practiced macrobiotic food preparations in California, beekeeping in Oregon, and making herbal crafts for local farmers markets in New Jersey, she has a wide variety of experiences and knowledge to share. Her passions include preserving food, gardening, practicing herbal wellness, caring for her animals, and living a lifestyle of minimal impact on the earth. Thank you for joining us, Jessica. Welcome to the show, and what is in your cup tonight?
Thank you all so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. Tonight I have what's called Freya, and it's from a local braggot company called Viking Braggot. And they actually make this with our honeybush tea, which is delicious. It's sweet. It's got this kind of bouquet of like berries and really like smooth, very sippable, really good spring summer drink. It was beautiful here in Oregon today, so I really wanted to harness that weather and have something that was reminiscent of spring. So this is kind of like spring in a cup.
Sounds good.
That sounds great. Well, thank you, Jessica, for joining us, and thank you again to Mountain Rose Herbs for sponsoring the secret ingredient of the Iron Bee again this year. The listeners have not gotten the, well, as of us recording this and probably when it's published, probably haven't gotten their ingredient yet. So we need to keep that a secret. So we don't want to give anything away tonight about what that secret ingredient is. But I think that there's a lot that they can learn about how to handle herbs and spices and what they can get out of them. And you know, we've had quite a few questions and discussion topics on the forums come around about the differences in powdered versus whole herbs and spices. And I think that's a good place for us to start. I know that you know, the flu season is upon us and around, and I was going to make some elderberry syrup. I've heard people have good results with that, and I've got powdered, you know, elderberry powder, and the recipe I found said, you know, was using whole dried elderberries, and you know, I was a little bit confused. What do I do? How do I think about, you know, the difference here between using powdered and whole and just in general? I'd love for you to talk about that.
Yeah, it's a really good question and one that we get a lot. So they really can be used universally. I really like to think of it as however you're going to take the herb best is the form that you should get it in. So if you are a smoothie drinker or, you know, you enjoy taking capsules for your supplements, then the powder is the best way to go for those instances. Personally, for like more tea preparations, tinctures, that kind of thing, I prefer the cut or the whole herb just because it does maintain freshness a little bit longer than powders. Powders, as you can imagine, oxidize a little bit faster. So generally, I do prefer cut and whole, but powder definitely has its place. And, you know, for elderberries, like you were talking about, if that's the only form that you have access to right now, then that's completely fine. It would just be a little bit more difficult to strain out the finer powder. So you might wind up with a little bit more of a gritty preparation, but benefits are still there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think that, if we go into, mead making here and somebody might be thinking about, with more surface area, I guess we'll say with powder, do you still need to use it one-to-one to get the same flavor? So I know, we'll talk a little about teas a little later, and some of the ways that you go about putting together a tea. But could you expect the same flavor in using a cup of powder versus a cup of the whole or cut?
I would personally tone down the powder just a touch, just because of the surface area difference. So I would maybe do for one cup of what calls for cut and sifted herb, probably about a little bit more than 3/4, because that would be the equivalent if you were to powder that herb. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. Jeff, I don't know if you still do, but I know for a while you liked making metheglins. What did you experience when you were using different kinds of herbs or different forms of herbs and spices?
Well, generally when I was doing it, I tried, I tried to get whole herbs and spices or, at least the full or roughly cut leaves as much as I could, for, much that same reason for one, surface area. A lot of the time I would take you know, for example, a nutmeg or a stick of cinnamon, and just really roughly break that up into some usable chunks so that they were easy to get into the meat and get out. to be perfectly honest, I've not played with powder very much just because of the cleanup factor. It seemed like I would be waiting a long time for that to settle, and anything I can keep relatively whole and stick in, like a coffee filter, for example, just seemed like a better choice. But the surface area argument makes a ton of sense and the need to reduce it. Jessica, if we could circle back to something you said just a moment ago, with the powders oxidizing a little faster. I know when we talk about oxidizing in meat or wine or things like that, we tend to get like some weird sherry flavors or some kind of wet cardboard flavor sometimes. What kind of flavors or what would we expect from an oxidized herb or spice? How would we know? What should we look out for?
Sure, that's a great question. So really, because there's such variation in the flavor of the particular herb, you'll notice a lot of color changing. So it'll lose a lot of its color. So if it was a green, you know, the chlorophyll will start to die off, and you know you'll wind up with a really like light green kind of herb. Also, the aroma won't be as strong. So really, kind of what we call organoleptic. It's kind of like how it looks, smells, tastes. Those are really the differences that you'll see. I wouldn't say that there's a particular flavor that I've seen across the board, or just because there is so many different herbs that, you know, we could be potentially talking about.
Could you make a tea out of the powder, you know, just mix it up with water and let it stand or let it steep for a while? Or how would you go about making a tea out of a powder in that respect?
Yes, so you could do that. It would just be a little bit more difficult to strain out. Yeah. So sometimes, say we're out of stock on a particular herb, we've had customers who have made, you know, their tea of choice with a powder that we carry, and then they'll just strain it out through, you know, a coffee filter or something that has a very fine particulate strainer.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I was just curious. You know, I suppose it would probably be easier to use the whole herb itself rather than the powder.
Right. And you could also break up. So, say you have a cut and sifted or a whole herb, you could put it in like a mortar and pestle or somehow break it up a little bit more. Just to kind of open up the cell walls and really allow that flavor to dissipate into the meat that you're making.
Yeah.
Now, let's go into the next, maybe dovetail into tinctures, making tinctures and extracts, and what you should... I guess the best methods of doing that, I guess kind of as I'm thinking here, would I, again, using you know, powdered versus the whole and when, I guess, and then we can even go a little farther out and say, what would make for a good tincture and what would make for a good extract in terms of, the type of herb or spice that you're using.
Sure. So you can make tinctures out of so many different things. So any kind of leaf material, flowers, barks, roots. And so there's a lot of different methods depending on what you're working with. I really prefer the folk method overall. And that's really kind of, you know, basically what our ancestors used to do when they made tinctures. And when they made herbal preparations, they kind of eyeballed it. In general, when making an extract, you want to use between a quarter, if you're using dried material, you'd want to use between a quarter and a half of the jar, whatever size that you're using. And that would depend on what material you're working with. So when you're working with dried, obviously, that's going to expand as the moisture in the liquid starts to, you know, soak into the material. And then from there, sure. You'd want to top off From there, you'd want to top off with your alcohol, your menstruum. And then with fresh, you can use a little bit more because it's obviously not going to expand as much, if at all. So with fresh material, you can use between a third and two-thirds plant material to alcohol ratio.
Is there a detectable flavor difference between using a fresh herb versus a dried herb?
Yeah, there definitely is. With fresh, you'll definitely get more of the brighter notes, whereas dried, you know, it'll tend to have a little bit more of an earthy flavor. I have read that from several herbalists that the dried material actually makes a better tincture if you're using it in herbal practice. I have to be careful with my language because the FDA doesn't like certain words, so I'm sorry if I have to pause and think about. Yeah, it's kind of a thing.
Yeah. So. Oh God, the government's always looking over our shoulders, yeah. Aren't they?
I know.
So our professional mead making friends are not able to add things like tinctures and extracts or something that would be, I suppose vanilla extract they could. I think that that's a sort of food product, but, aren't able to really add as many things as we are on the home side. You know, they can't necessarily make some sort of an alcohol infusion and then add that to their batches. But we can. And people like doing that because it really allows them to dial in that flavor. So instead of throwing in nutmeg, you know, a whole nutmeg, you can make a nutmeg tincture and then or extract and then just add a little bit to that to get the flavor that you want in your batch. Now, with that, there's been some questions around what is the best alcohol to use, or how much does the alcohol matter? I know there's typically, I'm oversimplifying, but it seems to me that there's often two different schools of thought on this, that or the two practices, I should say. One practice is they take, you know, ultra-proof, or, you know, overproof grain alcohol, like an Everclear, and they pour that in. And then on the other side, they take like a very expensive, you know, French vodka and pour that in, you know, that might have half the proof of the grain alcohol. So help us understand what you should be thinking about when you are selecting that alcohol that you're going to use to make those tinctures and extracts?
Sure, that's an excellent question. So with the really high proof stuff, that actually winds up burning the plant material. So I wouldn't recommend using a very high proof. Typically, if you're trying to extract, say, a resin or something like that, that would be an application for those really high proof grain alcohols. I would say between 70 to 95% alcohol by volume. It's kind of a safe zone for most plant material without burning it. On the lower side of that, if you're trying to extract some of the water soluble properties, you would opt for more of that 70% mark where, I'm sorry, I said that incorrectly. Proof. So 80 to 90 proof would be the lower end. So that's 40 to 50% alcohol by volume. Mm-hmm. So that would be really good for like more of the water soluble components of the herb. So you'll wind up with a lighter flavor, a little bit more flavor intact, where obviously the higher alcohol, you'll wind up with more of that harsh, like almost burnt kind of flavor.
Mm. Now, I recently moved, and packing up, you know, sometimes you find things that you had forgotten.
Huh.
And I had made this small jar. I was trying to make a mint extract that I was going to add, I think, like a blueberry watermelon mead or something. You know, I wanted it to be really just kind of summery. And I put a ton of like fresh mint in a little jar, and then I had topped it up with some sort of an alcohol. I don't remember, it was probably vodka. And it's been in there. Like I'm guessing I did that project 3-4 years ago, and it's still sitting. You know, I never did anything with it. I never strained it. I never opened it. I mean, it's still sitting in that jar. And I remember right when I did it, it was this just beautiful, vibrant green. And now it's this really
brown, dark,
you know, kind of, you know, just muddled color.
I'd handle it with rubber gloves, Ryan.
that got me thinking about the amount of time that you'd want to have your material exposed, you know, your plant or herb or whatever it is, exposed to it. And then, what would happen if you forget about it?
In other words, is it still any good?
Right. So the general rule of thumb in the herbal community is about 6 to 8 weeks is kind of like the ideal the ideal time zone. I definitely have done the same thing, so don't feel bad about it.
Me too.
Yeah, I mean, it happens. You know, it gets pushed to the back of the cabinet and you kind of forget. It's okay. You know, in general, we always just say to rely on your senses. You know, we can't tell you to eat something in your cabinet that's been there for 5 years for liability purposes.
Yeah.
But I've definitely been in a position where, you know, I've done that and, you know, it was a bigger batch and I have taken it and it's been just fine. But, you know, just always rely on your senses. If there's any kind of like, you know, any kind of mold issues around the rim or any kind of like the metal starts to corrode, anything like that, that's a toss job. Like definitely throw that out.
Like I said, Ryan, get your rubber gloves out. And by the way, you might want to get the barbecue tongs too and just put it in the trash.
But that's actually a really good
thing to be fine.
Call it a science project.
Also, when making tinctures, it is actually really good to shake the tincture every about 2 to 3 days. And that kind of activates the alcohol from going through the different cell walls and kind of stimulates the extraction process. And that's especially important for the first few days because you really want to observe whether or not that plant material is soaking up a lot of liquid. If it's exposed at all, like you want everything completely covered, obviously. So that's where you'll really want to check to make sure that things are looking good.
Let's move from science. Well, go ahead, Jeff. You want to say something?
I was going to ask a little bit about the ratios because, you know, I have a little bit of an odd quandary with my own tincture experience. I made a sage tincture over the winter just with some sage leaves harvested from my own garden. And, you know, you mentioned, I think it was about a third of the jar plant material, up to 2/3 if it's, thicker stuff. When I made mine, I basically just filled it full of sage leaves, kind of just packed it into the jar and then poured vodka into the, the little airspace in left between. Have I overdone it? Is it still going to be, you know, good? Is it still going to be usable, or should I try to tone that down some?
That would be a pretty strong tincture, but you could use it kind of like a concentrate at that point. So if you did want to tone it down, you would just use a little bit less. You could also, I've done that before where I kind of overdid it on the plant material, and then I just transferred it into a larger jar and then kind of diluted it with more alcohol just to kind of bring it down a little bit. But it's totally fixable and easy to do.
Okay. But as it is now, it's fairly concentrated, you're saying. So I could just use a few drops of that and still be good, ostensibly. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
Let's put the science projects back on the shelf for a minute. I want to talk about teas, which is something I haven't experimented with in my little brew room here, but am eager to try. I'm looking for a summertime, refreshing, quick drinker, low alcohol, adult beverage that I can put together. And I want to start using some teas. Now, teas to me come in two forms. One, herbs, making a tea from herbs, similar to a tincture, but not using alcohol, obviously. And then teas themselves, like regular, what would your approach be to you're not a home brewer, I understand, correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay, so this might be a difficult question. We generally work in 5-gallon batches of mead or beer, and so knowing the, I guess it's going to be a taste thing, but what would be your approach in putting together a tea to be added either during fermentation or after fermentation? What would be your approach?
So kind of akin to the Folk method that I was talking about with making tinctures, that principle can also be applied to tea making. So I really like to measure in parts. Mm-hmm. And that'll really enable you to kind of scale up for those larger batches that you're talking about. But then you can also just make yourself a cup of that tea if you have some leftover kind of situation.
Yeah.
So I kind of look at tea blending in three different, kind of like a triangle. So you have kind of your base. So that's the ingredient that you'll use the most of. So let's just say for argument's sake, we'll use three parts of a base.
Okay.
And then you go up the pyramid, and then you can use 1 to 2 parts of what you would call kind of like the supporting herbs. And that would kind of, you know, play nicely with that base note, but isn't quite like that top flavorful note. It's not going to be the first flavor that hits your palate, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then as you go up the pyramid, that's that initial top note that you'd want. So those are more of your really aromatic herbs, like, say, lavender or rose or citrus, the thing that would really kind of pop the tea blend.
So just to put that into practical application, let's say I wanted to make a chamomile hibiscus lemon blend. How would you go about kind of structuring that pyramid if those are the flavor notes I wanted?
Sure. So I would say that the chamomile would be the base note. It does kind of have this ability to stand alone. So I would, in that application, have that as the base. The hibiscus, what was the third one? I'm sorry.
Lemon.
Lemon, okay. So then I would say that the hibiscus would be that second note, and then the lemon would be that top kind of sharp note. You obviously wouldn't want to over-lemon the tea, right? So I would kind of deduce that way.
A
lot of these ingredients don't necessarily have to always live in the same category. So depending on the blend, you might have an ingredient that is sometimes the top note and sometimes the middle, or sometimes the base and sometimes the middle. So it really depends on the blend itself. But that's kind of like an overarching philosophy, I guess you would say, to tea blending. We do have some really lovely ingredients. If you'd like, I can give you some examples of what those could look like.
Please. Yes, please do.
Yeah. And so for the base, that honey bush tea that I was drinking in the Freya is lovely. It's very sweet on its own, very smooth, kind of fruity on its own, too. I love that tea. It's actually one of my absolute favorites.
What is it again?
It's called Honey Bush. It grows in South Africa on the Cape of Good Hope is where it's known to grow best.
Okay.
And it's absolutely delicious. It's kind of similar to like a rooibos. I don't know if you've ever had rooibos.
No.
No? Okay. So it's a red tea, and it's pretty sweet and smooth on its own. It's a very drinkable ingredient. I like to say that those two are like ingredients that people who don't even like tea would like. Very forgiving. And then another one that I really like as a base would be raspberry leaf. And then oat straw is also very lovely. And then so say like a middle note for those supporting flavors. I would say basil is actually a really good one, kind of unique. And I can also see that being really good in a mead, like maybe like a strawberry basil mead.
Sure, yeah.
Also, lemongrass is delicious. Holy basil is lovely. So those would be good, like, tie-in flavors that kind of accentuate the base but aren't going to totally pop the flavor. And then those top notes, like I mentioned, the citrus peel, orange peel. Cardamom could be a really good one, too. I really do like cardamom. Lavender, spearmint. Have you guys ever tried Shizandra berry before?
Oh, what?
I have not, but I hear that they taste like schnozberries.
Good reference.
Oh my god.
So Shizandra berry, they call it the five flavor herb because it has flavors that are sweet and salty, bitter, what's the other one, pungent and sour. So it has all five flavor notes in one berry. So you probably wouldn't want to use a lot of it, but I could see it adding a really interesting twist to a mead, especially if you like kind of like a little bit of a sour punch.
Wow. I've got quite a list going.
I want to just tell everybody, we'll take a little pause here for about 5 seconds so that you can go back and replay this section and take notes on everything that Jessica just said, because, you know, summertime is coming up fast. Everyone wants to make their session meads, their summer drinkers, their lawnmower meads, their sit by the pool meads, and Jessica just gave us about a dozen or more different things to think about in putting those together. So I'd say listen to that last few minutes a few times.
Yeah.
While you do that. As we wrap up here, and Jessica, thank you for being so generous with your time with us. Jeff and JD, any parting thoughts?
Well,
quick question on the tea subject, yeah. if I may. So I've played a little bit with some of the herbal preparations and things like that, and I've found I've used two different kinds of approaches here. In the first part, I've kind of just made a large amount of tea, boiling it, letting it steep, and then replacing the water in my brew with that. On the other hand, I've done what I would call kind of like a cold process where, after the main fermentation is done, I put leaves in there and just kind of let them sit and gather some, some of that flavor. Is there a major difference between like the hot extract flavors and the cold extract flavors?
That's a really good question. The heat definitely does tone flavors down, in my opinion. It kind of adds this, I don't want to say earthy. It's not earthy. How do I describe it?
Dirty?
It cut. I don't want to use that word either. It does change. It changes the flavor of the herb. So if you're really expecting more of a true flavor of the herb, I would say a cold brew is ideal in that situation, but you would want to let it sit for longer. Another option too is you could do basically a little bit less hot of a tea and then let it steep overnight. And that would create a really nice infusion too without kind of overcooking the herb, say.
Good point.
Okay. I might try that.
Yeah, good point. I tell you, Jessica, I've got like six kegs of ideas going here from from our discussion tonight. The hard part is going to be picking out the one I want to do first. So.
Oh, well, good. I'm going to send you my address. I can't wait to taste them all.
Well, do that. Ryan, you've got her. Do you have her information?
I don't have her personal mailing address. But
let's do that offline. Let's get a hold of Jessica offline, and let's get her in the loop here. You know, one more plug for Mountain Rose Herbs, and this is on a personal level. I have found that the herbs that I get, I do all the cooking in my house. I mean, from the provincial herbs to the simple ones like basil and oregano and those kinds of things. I'm telling you, you have upped my game in the kitchen.
No.
My sister too. I can't say enough about Mountain Rose Herbs. If my sister, if it weren't for her husband, she would sleep in her kitchen. Okay, she's a culinary hobbyist, and I turned her on to Mountain Rose Herbs, and now she swears by them. And she gets all of her herbs from Mountain Rose, Mountain Rose Herbs. So to our listeners out there, I'm serious. I mean, if you really want to up your game in the kitchen. With your herbs and spices, check out Mountain Rose Herbs. We'll put all the information in the show notes. Jessica, been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been super fun.
We'll have you back for sure.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Wow. Tons of information there. You just got to listen to, like Ryan says, play it back a couple of times. Play this first segment back a couple of times to get it all. But she said a lot in roughly about 35 minutes or so, 30 minutes. So, I haven't yet worked with any teas yet, but I'm eager. A couple of teas that my sister really likes is like these orange-flavored things and these lemon-flavored things. I've tried a couple of them. I could see where they could go really good in a mead or even a braggot, because I've been toying around with, we're going to talk here in the next segment about some of the flavors, might jump into that area as well. Let's go ahead and get into segment two. The Iron Bee, second time around, 2020, Iron Bee 2020. I understand everything is coming together masterfully, and Jeff and Ryan are on top of this. Unfortunately, I'm kind of in the background of things here because I won't be at the Iron Bee this year. But Jeff and Ryan, you guys got the 411 on the latest. What is it?
Yeah, we, as of us recording this, we have about 100 entries.
And exactly 100.
Wow.
Yeah, and so that means that we are half full already. Jeff, this week, is getting everyone that's registered so far, their packet out in the mail. They are hitting the mail this week. Again, you get the secret ingredient. You're also going to get some hops, and then you can make your mead with the secret ingredient, and then the hops are just there to inspire you as you make your braggot. And things are going well. A couple of questions I want to clarify. We've got a lot of people, since we've got a bigger entry pool, more open slots. So that means a lot of first time people in competition asking some questions, about the entries, and I wanted to clear a couple things up or try to be as clear as possible. When you create your entry, just create kind of like a dummy entry, we call it. I mean, we know you're not going to know if it's going to be sweet or dry or carbonated or still or what other flavors you might use because you don't even have the ingredient yet. So how would you know those things? So we know that. So just create a dummy entry, And then as you finish your mead, you'll go in, then you'll kind of update everything and say this, it's sweet, it's still, it's got other flavor notes in it. And then we'll send everybody as the time comes closer to mailing in, we'll kind of send everybody an update and just say, hey, just make sure you update your mead, your entry and have all that updated information in there. But things are going great. We're just thrilled by the amount of entries. We're thrilled that we're seeing a lot of different homebrew clubs represented. A lot of people really enjoy this now, the duality of the event, in that you've got the secret ingredient main event, and then you've got this Braggot challenge where any kind of Braggot you want to make is fair game, and that it's going to be judged on drinking pleasure. I've heard a lot of excitement around that. And things are just going great. So again, if you've been putting off registering, or you've had questions about registering, get in there, register. We still want to get your ingredients with as much time as possible to play with them. And this is also one of those really fun challenges, I'd say, for two other reasons. Number one, a ton of first-time competitors were in this last year, and a lot of first-time competitors are in it now this year. This is a great event for the first-time competitor. So if you are thinking, oh, I don't know if I'm ready to enter a competition, or if my stuff is up to that caliber, this is where you get into the pool, you know, dipping that toe into the pool. Because everybody's in the same boat. There's not somebody who's been honing their recipe for 35 batches and now they've got their strawberry basil mead just exactly dialed in. You know, this is, everybody's going to get an ingredient and you're just going to make whatever you can with it, the amount of time you have, and you send it in. And so it's a lot of fun that way. It puts people on kind of some even footing that way. It's a lot of fun. And you get two entries. You know, you get to make to your ingredient, you get to try your hand at a braggot, and you do that. So if you're on the fence that way too, if you think, oh, I'm a first timer or my buddy hasn't done it yet, encourage him or her to do it. And then lastly, this is also one of those really fun challenges where you can kind of do those like inter club or inter brew buddy challenges, where it's fun when you both enter. You know, I've got a few brew buddies around here, and in other competitions, we'd never be in the same category. Some guys tend to go sweet. I go dry, methaglens and melomels and things like that. And your wheelhouses don't line up. But in this competition, where everybody is kind of in the same category, it's one of those really fun ones to challenge the other guys in your homebrew club or challenge your brewing friends and do that. So I put that out to everybody here. Create a little challenge for your homebrew circle or your homebrew club. And see if you can get three, four, five, ten guys and gals to go in on this, and then when you get your score sheets back, have bragging rights, have a little bragging right challenge. And you know what? I'll even up the ante on that. Let's just make up a homebrew club. Quaff or Kansas City Beer Meisters or the Minnesota Homebrew Association. If you guys do that and you write us in and say, hey, you know, we're also doing a homebrew club challenge or a brew buddy challenge. Maybe it's just the Benjamin Street Brewers, and that's what you call the three neighbors that brew with you. If you guys do that, will let us know, and we'll send you a little another little award that you guys can give to whoever gets the bragging rights. So of course we'll have the big awards for everybody who wins on the grand stage. But if the Minnesota Homebrewers or the Kansas City Beermeisters or the Benjamin Street Brewers, say, hey, we got, five guys and gals or something like that, and we're going to do a little challenge here, we'll be happy to send you guys another little token award that can go to the high guy or girl for those bragging rights. So, want to wrap that up. And Jeff, what am I missing?
I think you've covered it. I mean, yeah, like you said, there have been a ton of people that last year this was their first competition. I am so pleased to see that so many of those guys are coming back. By the same token, we've got a lot of first timers coming out that have contacted us and had questions and said, "Hey, this is the first time I've ever entered a competition. This is the one I want to enter first," which is really gratifying. We love that. So, this is a great competition, and I love the inner club challenges. I have a feeling there are already a number of these in play. Just looking at the entries, looking at the homebrew clubs, and looking at, we may have like a couple like brother or cousin pairings where they have the same last name and they registered really close to each other. So I'm guessing somebody said, "Hey, let's try this and let's both enter and see what we get." I am really gratified to see all these entries and just that there is so much enthusiasm about it. And, really just keep entering, guys.
And if you're a first time competitor, go back to last May. I should have pulled up some episode numbers, but last year's Iron Bee was held sometime in May. I don't like the middle of May, I believe.
The end of May.
Yeah. Yep. So on our website, go back a few episodes. Go back to May, about the middle of May, and listen to some of those episodes following the Iron Bee. Let me tell you, it was my first. You won't believe what you're about to experience. You just won't. Some of the best tasting meads I have ever had came out of that Iron Bee, and I continue to taste. People keep sending me stuff that were there, and good friends of the Mead House. So it's a lot of fun. You'll really, really enjoy it. Let's move into Melomel's guys here a little bit. I kind of wanted to bring this around again. We talk so much about braggots. That's what all, two of us out of the show are pretty much, doing our own brew room in our own brew house. Jeff does a vast array of all different kinds of stuff, including braggots. Ryan and I pretty much focus on braggots. That's my mead of choice. And the show is kind of centered around that a little bit, but we need to get back to some of our other listeners out there who do other things besides braggots. Melomel's, guys. I don't know that we've grouped all of this. We've talked about Melomel's before, but I don't know that we've actually grouped this particular topic up in one segment. And what I'm talking about are the different types of flavorings. Now, there's just a bunch of them out there. You can use real fruit, concentrates, juices, and whatnot. We learned tonight from our guest, Jessica, at Mountain Rose. There's even these teas that give off these fruity components as well. I don't know what you classify a mead, a Melomel, if you used a fruit-based or style tea. I don't know why you wouldn't. If it tastes like blueberry, and you use a blueberry tea, what the hell's the difference? So let me throw it over to Ryan for a minute here. I'm sipping on a lemon juice, sparkling lemon. I don't know whether this is a braggot or not. Is it a braggot? Is this a braggot or just a straight up?
No, it's not a braggot at all.
Just a sparkling mead.
There's not an ounce of Not an ounce of malt in that.
Okay. So it's just a straight up sparkling mead, basically, with used with lemon juice. Outstanding. This stuff is, I mean, you could put a six pack in your cooler and take this to the beach and be gone in 10 minutes. It's just good stuff. So, Ryan, the different types of flavorings. Okay, what are some of the more common types of flavorings you use for your session braggots and session meads?
Yeah, so I just want to go back to what you said there for a second. I'm glad that you're enjoying that lemon, but I mean that lemon is really just a blank palate. I mean, and maybe it sounds like, you know, you're enjoying it as is, which is wonderful, but that's really just the blank canvas. The blank canvas is then, what do I want to do on top of it? You know, do I want to add some raspberry or strawberry, you know, kind of like make a raspberry lemon mead or a strawberry lemon mead or you know, maybe put some mint in there or something. I mean, that's like the base, you know, if you're thinking about this like a lemonade, right?
Yeah.
That's like the base lemonade. And then what are you going to do to kind of give it a little more pizzazz, you know, going forward? So all I was trying to do with that mead was just kind of create a canvas and saying, hey, this is a canvas to then do some fun things this summer on top of. And I'm glad it turned out well, because I think that's also what I'm going to do. I mean, like I said, you could drink it as is, and it's fine. My go-to meads are melomels as we get into summer here. So that lemon, you know, the lemon, and then the versions off of the lemon, I think are always nice. I don't do a lot of big dark fruit meads. I, you know what I mean by the dark fruit is, say, like, you know, the black currants,
yeah.
Or, you know, the blackberries and raspberries, you know, the things like that.
Right.
I enjoy the ones that are really well balanced, and there's some folks I know that make really good ones. But I don't always do those. I kind of go on the other side. I do some of the citrusy ones, so lemon, orange, lime, some things like that.
Real fruit, concentrates, juices, and juices I mean by regular, you know, not like taking a lemon and juicing it. I'm talking about like bottled juice, basically.
Real
fruit would be your lemon that you squeeze, your lemon juice. That to me, that's real fruit. So what type of, well, already your lemon, I mean, you already told me it's lemon juice, so I'm assuming you squeezed real lemons. So, but beyond
so
that.
I didn't squeeze the lemon. I used store-bought,
lemon,
you know, preservative-free,
okay,
you know, lemon juice. I've used like cans of the puree. So I made a mead, you know, a fruit by using the cans of like the pureed fruit. I also made a fruit, a melomel, by using some amaretti, not the extract, but the
concentrated
the bigger bottle. What do they call that?
Artisan compound?
Yeah, it's kind of like a tall, skinny bottle. And I had used that, you know, I kind of put that right into secondary. So I had made a base mead, just a trad, and then added that on top of it for a nice light flavor, the session mead, and, you know, just wanted a little light flavor, and that worked too. So I've done the juice, I've done the puree, I've done the extract. I've never made a mead only using it. But I have done the citrus peels, where you take like, you know, dried citrus peels. Like, you can buy like orange peel if you're gonna at brew shops, you know, if you're going to make like a wit beer or maybe, you know, a saison or something and you want to add some fruit to it. I've never done that just because I didn't think that'd be really efficient, but say, you know, you just take a massive amount of like dried orange peel and make an orange meat out of that. I suppose you could, although technically if you're using the peel, it might be a methaglin. I mean, I'd have to ask the BJCP, you know, expert Jeff on that. If you made a mead just using, say, orange peels, where that would fall. I imagine that you'd get some really great flavor. I mean, because a lot of, you know, in that out of the zest you feel.
What is your preference of the type of fruit to use when you make a session mead, you know, that you want to include some sort of fruit? What is the type of flavoring that you would, you know, is your preference?
Yeah, I'm going to let Jeff answer that question, though, first, because I did call out his name.
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
Sure. Well, my supposition is you would still want to enter that as a mellowed ball, even if you did specify, hey, this is just made with orange peel or, you know, lemon peel or lemon zest or whatever. Just because when I'm tasting it, I'm going to taste the fruit. And a lot of the time with citrus fruits, you get a lot more out of the zest or the peel of that fruit than you do out of the whole, like, fruit or the juice parts of it, especially from aromatic standpoints. So just a lot of the oils that are very aromatic and very, you know, present in a good mead come from the outside skin of that fruit. But when I'm drinking it, if I'm tasting fruit, I'm going to assume it's a melomel. I don't know that I would necessarily ding somebody and say, hey, you really should have entered this as a melomel instead of a methaglin. But, you know, you go by how it tastes, not by how it was made all the time. For example, you know, if you have five flavors in your mead, but only two of them are presenting, in that same vein of the rule of saying you only really want to list the two that are presenting, because you'll get dinged for having the other three not present, I would say enter it as a methaglin, just because it's going to taste like fruit.
What would be, you know, when we're talking about the different types of flavorings to use when you're putting a methaglin together, what is your preference, Jeff, whether it's a fruit, concentrate, juices? Do you have a preference?
To some extent, it does depend on the fruit. They're one of my favorite fruits to use, and I've said this so many times, is blueberries. And really, I had so many blueberry muffins growing up that I'm sick to death of blueberries in food. But I love blueberries in fermented beverages. I just do. Yeah. They taste great. I like to use whole blueberries when I'm using blueberries because I also want a little bit of that tannin extraction from the skins.
Yeah.
You know, that gives you some of the color. Because if you smush up a blueberry, more often than not, the inside is going to be clear.
Right.
And the skin is where all the color is coming from. And I like, especially with the session meat that I made last year and that I'm probably going to repeat again this year for spring summertime, I like that kind of pinkish purplish little, light coloration that the skin gives it. So I'll use whole fruit on that. Absolutely. And just smush it up, put it in a bag so it's easy to extract. More often than not, if I'm going to do anything else though, and I'm not really concerned about getting, tannin out of the skin, juice or, amaretti is really a great way to go as it's simple, it's easy, and cleanup and getting it off of the leaves is pretty easy. I've tried a couple purees, but I've been really disappointed in the results, and not just because, you know, not because the flavor was bad per se, but because the leaves tend to be really loose, really thick, and so, you know, you start with a 5-gallon batch, you end up with maybe 4.5 gallons at the end of it all. And even then, you've got to get it into a second container. You got to let that clear, and then probably rack it off into a third one before you bottle.
Well, and the other thing, we talk a lot about back sweetening, Ryan. And is there a problem in back sweetening with a fruit juice or some, you know, some sort of a concentrate that you've kind of dumbed down a little bit, you know, reduced down a little bit. You know, we talk about, you know, some people like to back sweeten with a, you know, a cup of honey or whatever, you know, sweetness level they're looking for. Now, why couldn't you accomplish the same thing using fruit juice to up the sweetness level a little bit? Have you ever done that before?
Yeah. So, you know, I don't typically back sweeten, but I bottle condition. And so I have bottle conditioned, which essentially is just is back sweetening, but I let the yeast keep going. You know, I mean, fermentation's, you know, you kind of get where I'm going with that, is that if I wasn't, if I was stabilizing it and I was adding this additional sugar, you know, I just wouldn't, it'd be sweeter, but I'm doing it to get a little more flavor or as I condition. I've done that with like cherry juice. So I've taken, I took a Braggot and I used cherry juice to bottle condition it. I've done that also when I want to bring out a certain flavor. I've bottle conditioned with the Cascade beer candy syrups, flavored beer candy syrups.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, with the different ones they have some fruity ones, also some like vanilla ones and things like that, that can help bring out, you know, those flavors. And so, yeah, I you don't have to just use, in the, I'm going to go back to bottle condition here, but you don't have to just use corn sugar to bottle condition, you know, which is the standard, you know, homebrew shops, things like that. You can bottle condition, you know, with juices or with candy syrup, flavored candy syrups, or with any of that stuff. So the same thing with your back sweetening. Sure, you know, you just take into account the amount of sugar that you're going to want to bring out, you know, a little bit, and what the volume change might do to your ABV, and making sure that you've got, you know, all that stuff accounted for, at least know where it is, and then you can do that. You know, I mean, you could add, you know, candy syrup or honey or juice or any of that stuff.
Yeah, I just
and actually, you know. There's a local meat maker, a guy local to me, that I know for a fact that he does, I want to say, three or four different flavors. One of them's a raspberry, one of them's a blackberry, and one of them's traditional. He just makes a big batch of traditional and then splits it off and back sweetens with either the raspberry or the blackberry, bottles it up, and good to go. That's his whole process. And I know for a fact that his blackberry has won, you know, major awards. It is really good, and it's just been black. It has just been back sweetened with blackberry.
Yeah,
God, that was hard to say.
Yeah, that's a mouthful. Huh? I get it. I mean, I guess there's something nostalgic about, you know, putting 40 pounds of fruit into a fermenter and, you know, coming up with a, you know, a strawberry melomel or a blackberry melomel, whatever. But, I, you know, I think for cleanup sake, for cleanliness sake, I lean more towards the juices and the concentrates. I keep harping on Amaretti. I mean, they're probably one of the best I've found. A lot of great flavors there. But you can also go to places like Trader Joe's. And get, I mean, they have well, even my local Ralph's, you know, I can't count them out, but you know, you can pick up some unadulterated, and by that I mean they're not, you know, there's no preservatives, no other crap. It's pure juice, 100% juice. Now, some of them may be from a concentrate. That's not such a bad thing either. I think juices are the way to go. You know, I'm looking forward to doing, you know, a couple of flavors for the summer. You know, maybe a blueberry. I like the light. I think it was you. I had one of your blueberries. It was just a light blueberry flavor. Really tasty. Not tart, not real sweet. just right in the middle, good balance, but you still got that blueberry flavor. And it wasn't even blue or dark blue. It was like, you know, it was like almost golden color. And I'm thinking, wow, this is blueberry. you know, it's an amazing fruit. And I think using a juice or a concentrate, is far better than, like I say, 40 pounds. You know, if you want the tannins and the color and whatnot, I guess that's fine. If you want to use, you know, not saying that any one is bad, okay, but I think people have preferences, and we just want to make our listeners aware of the different types of, you know, fruit flavors out there besides just, you know, going and out and buying, you know, 40 pounds of frozen blueberries or whatever.
Yeah. No, and especially if you're going to make something light for the summer, like a session mead that you're going to carbonate.
Yeah.
Juice or an amaretti concentrate makes a great solution to that, because you can dose it to the amount of flavor you want in it. And I mean, like, one of my favorite hacks for this is, if you go to like your Whole Foods or your natural grocers or any of the more organic markets in your town, go down their juice aisle, you can find like blackberry concentrate for something like, I want to say, $8 to $10 a quart. Throw one of those in there, and you've got a ton of black cherry flavor.
There you go.
I'm sorry, black cherry concentrate is what I meant to say.
Yeah,
you get a ton of that flavor. We've done my wife's sangrias. I've done some other like mixed fruit kind of things with that, and the concentrated flavor is great. You get a lot out of that for a really small, you know, outlay in cash.
Yeah. Good stuff. All right. We got about 10, 12 minutes left here, guys. We've got a ton of Facebook friends here that piled up over the last couple of weeks on our hiatus. This is where we try to answer questions with no formal expertise other than what we've experienced in our own brew room. Jeff, fire it off, bud. I know you got a couple on this list.
Sure. So this was actually not a question so much as just a note from one of our previous guests, Jacob Thill. He was our guest on episode 15. And he just says that, hey, I got done listening to episode 148 and wanted to toss some info your way. Olive oil. We talked about olive oil a couple episodes back. You remember?
Yep.
He says it is or was used as a source of fatty acids, things that are vital for yeast growth. Yeast produce those with oxygen. They're also present in Fermate K for exactly the same reason. You all mentioned you were going to try some brewing with olive oil versus nutrients versus aeration, see what the results were. Keep in mind, a lot of the olive oil experiments are in beer, not wine, and the nutrients are different, especially with higher ABVs. So most studies on this report better, stronger, longer, lasting flavor due to the reduced oxygen, but increased ferment times in commercial applications. That'll probably be exaggerated in low YAM, yeast available nutrient musts, where the nutrient levels are low, and higher ABVs. The Brewlosophy article is a bit of an outlier in this because the olive beer fermented faster. Usually that's not the case. So that's just a little bit of information that he wanted to throw our
Excellent.
Way.
Excellent. Thank you, Jacob.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then John Thoth threw a question our way via Facebook that I wanted to get out here. He says he's a fairly new listener, also a home brewer. He's a big fan of the show, but he's gotten many ideas from listening to the podcast, but he needs some advice. Sure. He says, I've made a few batches of mead. My first was a blueberry vanilla on January the 6th, and it turned out okay. It just has a notable yeast-like aftertaste that he can't seem to get rid of. He used 71B, fermented it at 75 to 80 degrees ambient temp, added the blueberries in primary, 3 pounds of honey from his backyard bees, and he was curious if we had any knowledge as to how to get rid of that flavor or what he could do differently next time. He was also curious what the process of back sweetening is. He has a second question regarding Jameson Irish whiskey and how we would do a Jameson reinforced meat. So he doesn't know where to start or how much Jameson to use.
The yeast thing, right off the top of my head, I'm going to say temperature maybe.
He was going pretty hot for that yeast.
Yeah, for 71.
Yeah, I want to say the upper range on that is 75, so a little over that temperature range.
Yeah, yeah. I would ferment John at a little lower temperature. When I use 71B, my go-to temp is 68 degrees, and that's
yep,
it.
Same.
Yeah, I try to go no higher than that. I think I'm getting the best out of the yeast at that point. I'm getting the best out of all of the other additives that I might have in that particular batch. 68 degrees. Try to stay right there. You can even go lower if you want. 65. It'll still ferment at 65. I've had good ferments at that temperature too. The Irish whiskey thing. That's kind of my wheelhouse, dealing with whiskey, bourbons, and whatnot.
Yes, it is.
This is purely, John, a taste thing, okay? Strictly a taste thing. Always will occur in secondary, obviously. But this is something where you really need to be on the money, okay? Because once you put it in, you can't take it out, like a lot of other things that we deal with, in our mead making. So get yourself a couple of graduated, it could be a measuring cup, but something that has graduated marks on it, and you just need to experiment and find that flavor level that you're looking for. That's my best first advice. After that, if you want to take the risk, start out with a quarter of a cup, stir it up, taste it. If you don't get what you're looking for, add another quarter cup, just a quarter cup at a time until you get to the point where you think you're at where you need to be. That's my
now,
best
JD,
advice.
Is that a quarter of a cup into 5 gallons or into 1 gallon?
Into 5 gallons.
Because there's a difference.
Yeah, no. Into 5 gallons. Yeah, right. You don't want to, Jameson Irish Mead. No. What we're looking for is a little bit of that whiskey flavor in the meat itself. So yeah, quarter cup or 5 gallons. You'll be surprised. Believe me. I've dumped cups of bourbon into meads, and the mead, it's basically bourbon flavored mead. I mean, it's just, you can really go overboard with it very, very quickly. So you got to be kind of careful when you're adding, things like whiskeys, to meads. Another way that you really want a nice Irish whiskey mead, soak some wood. Soak a medium toast chunk of oak in some good iron. Now, I'm not going to say anything bad about Jameson, okay? It's on the lower end of expense, but if you want a nice Irish whiskey, go a little bit higher, spend a little bit more money, soak some wood in it, and put the wood in first, okay? Leave it in there for 6 weeks, okay? Start tasting it, and then start adding a little bit of that same Irish whiskey back into the meat until you get to your flavor that you're looking for. That's my best on that.
Oh, yeah, I'll second that. The other nice thing is he's talking about adding whiskey to a traditional, a little bit of wood will also give them some tannins and round out the meat, make it taste nice too.
Yeah.
So, I think that's a home run.
Yeah, and if you want to kick it up a notch, it really, if you're only, one thing that I found that you can really, you can define that whiskey flavor a little bit more by even adding things that are commonly, that you find common in bourbons. Like vanilla, okay? Not a whole vanilla bean. You start out with maybe a quarter of a vanilla bean. You're just looking for the essence of vanilla, not vanilla. You don't want a mouthful of vanilla. You're just looking for the essence of that vanilla. That's a very common flavor found in good bourbons, good whiskeys. That all comes from the barrel itself. So other things like brown sugars, things that will brighten up that bourbon or whiskey flavor a little bit, might coax it along a little bit more. So that's all I'll say on that. Ryan, throw the mic over to your side of the house here. Facebook friends.
Yeah. We had a few different ones. We were talking about fruits, and I was talking about citrus fruit. And Anthony said grapefruit juice, orange juice, and raw honey, all from my family's grove.
Wow.
Any tips?
Anthony, let me get you my address.
any tips on running citrus in initial fermentation?
That sounds like a Ryan question.
Talk about
that's a Ryan question. That's a Ryan question right there.
Yeah, sure. I was going to say, I've heard a lot of people say that they've had trouble with citrus fermentation. I never have. Never. And the reason that I don't think I've ever had is I'm not loading up the, you know, heart of darkness quantity of fruit in those meads. You know, I'm not doing pounds and pounds per gallon. I'm adding, you know, session mead stuff. So session mead amounts of citrus. I would say that, you know, if you want to make a nice, you know, refreshing mead, grapefruits, oranges, that kind of thing, juice, I think you can put your juice in primary. I mean, you can zest all that stuff. I think you might have two choices when you zest. You could drop the zest right into maybe secondary and get some really bright flavors there. Or, you know, thinking about what Jessica was talking about, you could take all that zest and fill up a jar and make a little tincture out of it. And then you mm-hmm. could add that, you know, in as well. But I think, you know, it might be labor intensive, but I would zest all of that fruit before I juiced it, so that I can kind of give it a 1-2 punch there with the juice and, you know, first the juice and then the zest. That's just how I think I'd handle it. What would you add, Jeff?
So I would go for it. Again, I would zest it and then juice it. I have found I tried once to juice first and then zest. Does not work. That's way more labor intensive than you want to get into. That said, as far as problems with citrus ferments, I know basically every stall that I think I have run into has been because I wasn't degassing at the first week or so, and my pH was dropping because a lot of the CO2 became dissolved in solution, which formed carbonic acid and just like made that pH plummet. And it was very hit or miss. Not every batch I did before I started degassing stalled on me. It was kind of just, you know, once in a while, it's stalling again. Damn it. So watch your pH. And if you're going to throw in a ton of grapefruit juice or lemon juice or something like that, or orange juice, you got to keep an eye on it. And 3.0 on the pH scale seems to be kind of that trouble zone. If you go a little bit lower than that, the yeast is going to just say, nah, I'm out. I'm done. I'm not going to do anymore. So try and keep it above that as best you can. And maybe that means, you know, you're only adding a little bit of the juice into primary, and you're adding a little bit more into secondary once things have progressed a little bit further and you've got closer to a finished mead. But I would definitely say that, the zest is, like I said before, the zest is a strong aromatic profile. All the oils and stuff that come out of that, they're also, like Ryan mentioned, great for a tincture opportunity there. The juice itself, I would still put in primary at least a little bit just to get some of that flavor, get some of the yeast chewing on the sugars involved in it, and just kind of get incorporated. You may not want to put all of it in up front. It's kind of going to be a trial and error, touch and see, so to speak. So, but I would definitely go for it. That sounds amazing.
Good enough. All right, guys, we're going to leave it right there. There's another Facebook friend here that we need to get to. We're going to move to the top of the list for next week. It's from John. He's talking about a braggot. And I was just reading through it. You're right on the money, dude. We'll get into more of that in the next episode of the Mead House. For now, hey, John Toth, Jake and Phil, and I believe it was Anthony. Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it. And we're going to dump it here right now. Thanks for listening and hanging out with us this episode. And special thanks to Jessica Nebesny from Mountain Rose Herbs for stopping by. And I can't say enough about these guys. If you don't believe me, go back to the top of the show and play the lead into this episode one more time. Hey, don't forget, let us know what you're brewing. We might even give you a call. Email us, info@themeadhouse.com, or just send us a message on Facebook or on the Twitter, both at The Mead House. So, in the meantime, you know how it reads. Happy mead making. That's it for this episode. Ryan, flip the lights off. Jeff, slam the door shut. Hey, we'll be back next week with episode number 151 of The Mead House. We're gone.